This is the lecture tape for February 10th, 1999. We're in Deuteronomy chapters 12 to 15, applying the covenant with regard to worship and debt. Well, last week we saw Moses' heartfelt plea to love and obey God because God had first loved Israel. Part of loving him was to obey the commandments, and now Moses is going to explain how they are to apply to their lives once they reach the promised land. It's been 40 years since Moses first gave them the commandments of the Lord, and during this time, they have been living in the wilderness as nomads. Once they enter the promised land, they will be settled in cities and towns. They will have farms, and they will raise herds and flocks. So Moses is giving them a fresh interpretation, if you will, as to how God expects them to apply this in their lives once they enter the promised land. Well, chapter 12 deals with honoring God through worship. Look at verse 1. These are the decrees and laws you must be careful to follow in the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess as long as you live in the land. Now, we saw from our lesson today that Israel was not following God's laws. Even though they knew God's laws and commandments while they were in the desert, it appears that they weren't following them. Look at verse 8. You are not to do as you do here today, everyone as he sees fit. Well, Moses reminds them, once they go into the land now, they must follow God's laws if they want to receive his blessings. And then he reminds them again about what God says about them. He says, you are my people. I love you. I chose you. I'm in the midst of you. I will protect you. I am asking only that you obey me for your own good. Israel, you're to be holy because I am a holy God. He goes on then to repeat the instructions to break down all reminders of the false gods in Canaan and to wipe out their names. Now, this is interesting because this is a new addition here, wiping out their names. In our study of Genesis and Exodus, we saw how important a name was and the fact that several times names were changed to reflect either their new position, their new status, or their new role. It's always fun when ancient history documents, secular documents, record similar events as the Bible. In this case, ancient Egypt practiced this art of erasing a name. In fact, if a pharaoh was discredited or removed, every reminder of him, whether it was a plaque on a building, whether it was a statue, anything, stone, wood, was totally and utterly destroyed in order that his name would be completely removed from history. Now, another way it was done in ancient history was to use a curse. They would call down a curse by their gods to bring disaster upon the one whose name was to be wiped out of the pages of history. It's interesting, this wiping out is the word hireem, and we saw that last week or 2 weeks ago. It means to utterly destroy, and it's the same word that God has used with regard to wiping out the seven nations of Canaan and their gods. Well, after commanding the destruction of all references to their gods, Moses goes on to tell Israel about what is and what is not acceptable worship. He begins by saying it's unacceptable for Israel to worship the way the Canaanites did. Now, the Canaanites looked upon worship in a very simplistic way. They wanted an abundant harvest, so they indulged in practices that they thought would encourage fertility and growth. What happened is their worship essentially became a religious sanctified sex orgy. Moses says, you must not worship the Lord your God in that way. This is detestable. Acceptable worship would honor his name, reflect his nature. Yahweh is holy, so worship must be holy. Yahweh does not change, so they are to keep worship the way God had designed it. They were not to worship one way this week and another way next week. Yahweh is loving, so their worship should never ignore his moral values. It was also unacceptable to worship Yahweh in any of the Canaanite hilltop shrines or groves. Now, the Canaanites worshiped gods of nature. Consequently, their shrines were everywhere. If there was a tree or a rock or whatever it might be, they would put up a shrine and they would worship there. Look at verse 5. But you are to seek the place the Lord your God will choose from among all your tribes to put his name there for his dwelling, and to that place you must go. Moses is saying once they reach the promised land, they're to worship in only one place, just as they do here in the desert. If you remember the setup of the camp of Israel, the tent of meeting was always the very center, and God resided there, and he was constantly visible. In the daytime it was a pillar of cloud, in the nighttime it was a pillar of fire. Now Israel, even though they weren't coming to worship on a regular basis, still had his presence and felt his guidance and protection upon them. Once Israel reaches the promised land, they will be scattered throughout a large territory, and it will be important to preserve their unity, both in faith as well as a nation. And God says acceptable worship will not be at the Canaanite locations, but only to the place that he will designate. He goes on to say that at that place, that's where they're to bring their sacrifices, and they begin with the burnt offering. That was the voluntary offering. It was given totally to the Lord from the heart as a form of thanksgiving to him. Whatever the animal was, it would be totally consumed in flames in the presence of the Lord. It goes on to the other sacrificial offerings, which were the mandatory ones, and he says those are to be shared. Part of it would belong to the Lord, part of it would go to the priests, and then a portion would go to the people who brought it. Look at verse 7. And there in the presence of the Lord your God, you and your family shall eat and shall rejoice in everything you have put your hand to, because the Lord your God has blessed you. God meant for worship to be a time of extreme happiness. It was to be a joyful occasion, a time of thanking God for his blessings and his goodness. Moses says it's best in chapter 33, verse 29, when he says, "Blessed are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by the Lord." Well, these times of worship were also to include the entire family. Look at verse 12. And there rejoice before the Lord your God, you, your sons and daughters, your men servants and maid servants, and the Levites from your town who have no allotment or inheritance of their own. Now, these acts of worship were intended to unify the nation, but it was also intended to bring families together. God said if his people would put him first and draw near to him, it would also bring them closer to one another. By keeping God's laws and worshiping together, then families would be reminded of not only the spiritual values, but also the moral ones, and the fact that God was involved in their everyday lives. By adding the men servants and maid servants to the family worship, God is essentially saying every individual is important to him, and they are all to come and worship, regardless of their place or status in life. God also chose the time of worship for Israel to show their love and support of their spiritual leaders. You'll remember that the Levites have no inheritance of their own. They were dependent upon the people to bring their tithe before the Lord, which became the Levites' portion. What would happen if they didn't do this? Then the Levites would have to go and find some other means for food, and they would neglect their duties to the Lord. So God says in verse 19, be careful not to neglect them as long as you live in the land. Now, up to this point, meat was considered sacrificial to the Lord. Moses says that once they go into the land, they may want to eat it as a source of food. And he says that's okay, because God has given animals to man for food. Since this food animal has no relationship to the worship animal, he says then everyone can participate in it, whether they're clean or unclean. The sacrificial animal was a way of transferring their sins to the animal and making it right with God, and they had to be clean in order to participate in that. But he says not when it's food. Food can be consumed by anyone, whether they are clean or unclean. Now, it's important for us to understand that even when they enter the promised land, meat is not eaten on a regular basis. The flocks and the herds were basically their livelihood, not for meat, but for the wool and the milk they produced. If they consumed their livelihood, they would become destitute, so they didn't eat meat. It does mention the gazelle and deer, and the most common meat that they ate was that which they would hunt. Now Moses says it's okay to eat an animal after you've killed it, but you must remember one law, and that's in verse 24. You must not eat the blood, but pour it on the ground like water. The taking of a life of an animal doesn't change whether it's a sacrificial or whether it's a food animal. life is still in the blood, and as such, they are recognizing that God is a giver of life, and it's God who has the authority to take life. Now, God's given them permission to take the life of an animal for food, so by pouring the blood out on the ground, they are acknowledging the fact that that life is to be returned back to the Lord. Well, one final warning is given in chapter 12. He says, don't even inquire about the Canaanite gods, because if you do, they will ensnare you. And then verse 32, see that you do all I command. Do not add to it or take it away. God is saying his commands are complete as they stand. Beware, don't add to them. Don't change them. Now, this is given in the Old Testament, but it also applies to you and I today because we find it in the New Testament in Revelation, the very same warning. Chapter 13 continues on with false worship, saying to be alert that it may come from three very unlikely places: the religious system, family and friends, or even from the community. Within the religious system, now the Canaanite prophets and diviners would be easy to detect as false, but Moses warns that false prophets will come from within, and these are far more dangerous. He says, even if they use signs and wonders that come true, be alert. See who it is that they're giving credit to. Is it to God? Is it to Yahweh or not? Now, a test of a true prophet is always that he stands for God's standards and he draws people to God, whereas a false prophet will do the exact opposite. Moses is the greatest prophet in the Old Testament, and he knows that Israel is going to face many false prophets, and he warns them that these might be a test from the Lord to see whether Israel truly loves him with all their heart and soul. He also says if a false prophet is found among them that they are to be condemned to death and stoned in order to purge Israel of him. He also says the false worship might come through family or close friends. Look at verse 6. If your very own brother or your son or daughter or the wife you love or your closest friend secretly entices you, saying, let us go and worship other gods, even if a close relative tries to turn you away from the Lord your God, you are not to yield to him or to listen to him. Show him no pity. Do not spare him or shield him. You must certainly put him to death, and your hand must be the first in putting him to death, and then the hand of all the people. Stone him to death because he tried to turn you away from the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Moses saying the penalty is the same no matter who tries to draw you away from God. It is death by stoning. Israel must be purged of anyone that would lead them astray. Verse 13 goes on to say it could even happen in a whole community. Wicked men have arisen among you and have led the people of the town astray. God says it doesn't matter where the source is, the result and the penalty is the same. In the case of a community, he said it is to hireem, utterly destroy. That's the same word he said about the Canaanite gods and the seven nations of Canaan. What he's saying is that city that has followed a false prophet so much that the whole town is following it must be utterly destroyed, just as Canaan is to be, and then those ruins are to be left in a heap, which actually became a tell, so that when anybody walked by, they would be warned that this is what happens to those who turn away from God. Chapter 14 takes us on to honoring God in your conduct. Moses again reminds them that they're a special people, chosen out of all the nations on the earth to be that treasured possession. And because of this, Israel is to be different from their pagan neighbors. And then he brings out in two different areas how they deal with mourning and how they deal with their diet. Chapter 14, verse 1 says, do not cut yourself or shave the front of your heads for the dead. Part of the Canaanite grief ritual was to cut the body with sharp stones and knives and to tear out the hair. Secular documents say he cuts his cheeks and chin, lacerates his forearm. He plows his chest like a garden. Like a veil, he lacerates the back. It sounds gruesome to me. I can't imagine anybody doing that to their own body. But God said such practices are forbidden because they dishonor God. Why? Because he gave the body as a priceless gift, and because they do irreparable harm to it. The body belongs to God. He expects it to be cared for properly and respectfully. The pagan culture or custom of self-mutilization was performed as a ritual for the dead because death had robbed them of the loved one and they had no hope of ever being reunited. God said, my people aren't to be like that. My people aren't to mutilate their body as one who has no hope. The next verses continue on and talk about what Israel's diet is to be like. Now, spiritual principles were just as important in the home as they were for worship. Moses says, don't compartmentalize your life with religion being sacred and then all the rest being secular. Obedience to God is in everything, your family, your worship, and even what you bring to the table. God is interested in their whole lives, not just in the religion. Although there's many speculations as to why God gave them certain foods and avoided other ones, in fact, there's varying opinions on it, and I've given you a couple of them in your handout today. Israel would not have looked for a reason. Israel was a covenant people, and as such, they were commanded merely to obey God. And so if God said that that was a law, then they would have obeyed it without questioning as to why he gave it. Well, moving on from the physical and spiritual, God continues on and said that they're to worship him also with their material wealth. The giving back to God of the first fruits was a way to remind Israel that God was the giver of the harvest. If it weren't for God, they wouldn't have the soil, the strength, the sun, or the rain, all of which were necessary to produce the harvest. Each year they were to bring the very first portion, the very best, to a central area of worship that God would designate, and there before the Lord they would have a celebration meal. And at that time, all family members, including the servants, were to participate along with any Levites. It was interesting because he said every third year, a portion of that was to remain in their own towns. That would be the third year and the sixth year, and that was a way of providing for the poor. A portion of it would still have to be returned to the main worship area because they still had to support the priests and the Levites, but a good portion of it then was to remain in their own hometowns. Why did God command that they do this? Well, the Canaanites had a fertility ritual by which they brought their first fruits before their gods. And God says, I don't want you to do it the way the Canaanite does. You are to bring them to me, not to any of the fertility gods of Canaan. Chapter 15 deals with the poor and the needy. Even though God is building a nation, the individual was never overlooked. In God's sight, every single man, woman, or child, whether they were rich or poor, had value and worth, and special care was to be taken for their needs. God's design, as you saw today, was that there would be no poor. If they fully obeyed God, everybody would have all that they need, but God knew that that wasn't going to happen. And so here he singles out three people, or types of people, for special mention: the debtors, the poor, and the servants or slaves. He said these people were to benefit from the year of release, which would be every seventh year. So he begins with the debtor. Now, debt in the ancient world was rarely due to irresponsible spending. They simply didn't have money. It would generally come about in a couple of ways. Poor harvest. You have a poor harvest for 1 or 2 years, and pretty soon the entire family's in debt. In fact, it may be even a whole region that gets involved in debt. Another way is a death. If the husband or the father dies and a wife with small children is left, it doesn't take very long before she becomes in extreme debt. God said every seventh year there was to be an absolute forgiveness of all debt. Now, this is an expansion of what we found in Exodus 23:10, which was the sabbatical year. At that point, God said every seventh year the land was to rest. They were not to plant anything that year. Well, God says also on that year you don't plant, you're to forgive everybody's debt. Now, some of the commentaries felt that the debt was only forgiven for that 1 year, but most of them agree that it was a total and complete forgiveness. Otherwise, they would never be able to get out of debt. The next category is the poor. Though poverty was not part of God's economy, as I said before in verse 11, they will always be with you. I don't know if you noticed this or not, but he talked about the Hebrew in verse 12. And I thought, wait a minute, they're all Hebrews. Abraham was a Hebrew. They're all descended from Abraham. Therefore, they would all be Hebrews. Aren't they all Hebrews? Yes, they are. Well, aren't they all Israelites too? And the answer to that is no. The differentiating factor between an Israelite and a Hebrew was land. Israelites owned land. Hebrews did not, and without land, they could very easily become destitute. God said that when a harvest came in, they were to give to their brother Hebrews and do so with an open hand. Why were they to do this? Because God commanded it to, and because it by obeying God that God could continue to bless them. The last category is the servant or the slave, and as you saw in your lesson today, slaves in Israel were not victims of ruthless oppression like we think of slaves today. It was actually more like a live-in employee. It was an extended family. We saw in your lesson today there was many different ways that a person could become a slave, quite often selling themselves into that. When a foreigner became a slave, and we see that as they go in and conquer the land, sometimes they take the people if God commands it. They are to be circumcised, and then they're brought into Israel as brothers. So they don't remain slaves, but become part of the family. God says on the seventh year they're to be released. And when they are released, the master is to provide a generous farewell present, including food, clothing, and whatever occupation he's in, whether it's farming, he would give them grain, or whether it was herding, he would give them flocks or herds, in order that they could go out and begin a new life. Without that, they would just go out and become slaves immediately again. God said they were to do this because when that servant was part of their family, God had blessed them abundantly because of that servant, and so it was their duty and their responsibility to help that servant then get a fresh start. Now, a servant might decide, well, I don't want to go out there and do all this work. I'm perfectly content to be part of this family, in which case the servant could choose to remain for life, and then they would go through a ceremony and the ear would be pierced, and that servant then would remain with that family for life, with that family then being responsible for the care and the welfare of that servant for his or her entire life. Why did God say they were to do that? Verse 15, remember that you were slaves in Egypt and the Lord your God redeemed you. Israel had once been a slave and God had graciously come and saved them, and so he expects Israel in return to treat its slaves or servants in the same manner he had treated them. Well, God told Israel that they were to put him first in their lives, and if they did that, everything else would come out right. And putting him first meant obeying his commands and decrees. In order to do that, they had to first know what they were. You know, that part of God's plan has never changed since it was given to Israel. If you and I will put God first in our lives, then everything else will come out right. We've seen numerous examples of that even within our Bible study here as we've prayed for needs and as we've seen God become central in the lives, how everything has fallen into proper perspective and that those needs have been met. We've also known within our group, but also as we've looked at Israel, particularly the wilderness time, and we'll see it more as we go into the future in the Promised Land, that when God takes care of us, it doesn't necessarily mean that he will give us abundantly above what we need at the time. It may be just one mouthful to the next, but he does care for and he does protect those who come to him and put him first in their lives. A verse that stood out to me so clearly in this section was 12:32. See that you do all I command you. Do not add to or take away from it. It's just another reminder to Israel, and I believe to us, the importance of knowing God's words. The danger of taking God's words and twisting them just a little bit by adding or taking away can make an entirely different new meaning than what God had intended. And we see that's exactly what Satan used back in the garden. He took God's words and twisted them just a little bit, and he was able to deceive Eve. God told Israel that it would come from many different places, even from within, the religious system, the family, friends, or the community. It's the same for us. In fact, we've seen it most recently within the religious community with what they're calling the prosperity gospel. They say, if you give to us, meaning if you give to God, then God will have to in turn give back to you more than what you gave. Now, there's nothing in Scripture that says this. In fact, they even use these verses that we're studying here. But God's not a genie. You can't say some magic words and then God has to perform. If you look at it in context, God says, when you see a need among your fellow Israelites or fellow Hebrews, you are to meet those needs out of your abundance because I had blessed you. And you're not to hold back. And you're to give it with a heart of love and a heart of obedience. But it doesn't say God will then bless you abundantly. What he says is, then I can continue on blessing you as I have. I won't have to bring a curse upon you or consequences upon you because you disobeyed. So what God is saying is, when you see a need, give liberally, but don't give with the attitude of getting back. Give with the attitude of obedience, and then the result will be God will continue to bless you. What am I saying? I'm saying it's important to continue to read and study God's Word so that we can know what it is that God is really saying. Spend time as you would a love letter, which in fact the Bible is. It's God's love letter to His children. Learn to know it for yourself so that when something is added or taken away, you will not be fooled. Let's pray. Father, help us as we study these lessons of Israel, that they'll be an example to us, that we will learn from their lives to be obedient, to know your words, and to love you. Be with us now as we go through this next week. Help us as we continue on and study how you dealt with your nation Israel, that we would learn what applies to our lives so that we could also be your faithful servants. We love you, Lord. Amen.